New York City, once considered the national epicenter in the fight against COVID-19, now health experts fear a Texas city has taken its place. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Hospitals in Houston struggling to deal with a pandemic on a scale similar to that of New York City in late spring. Our conversation with New York Times reporter Dr. Sherry Fink. Also, a warning from climatologists about a coming drought that could reshape Texas for the long term. And getting schooled by Selena, a Texas university launches a first-of-its-kind course. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this primary runoff day 2020 in the Lone Star State. I'm David Brown. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday, July 14th. Much at stake as voters head to the polls statewide one more time before the general election. It's expected that by the end of this evening, we'll know the name of the Texas Democrat who will be running against John Cornyn in November, as well as challengers in several congressional races that promise to be highly competitive in the fall. We'll have a bit more later in the broadcast. The presumptive Democratic presidential nominee today made his first major media volley in Texas, a TV ad campaign which includes a 60-second spot that opens with a picture of Marfa and a message. The virus is tough, but Texas is tougher, and we're in this together. The message speaks to a grim reality that hasn't spared rural Texas the way some months ago hoped it might. The pandemic has reached all corners of the Lone Star State, not just its cities. In a similar way, back in late spring, many Texas cities presumed they'd been spared the worst, too. Back then, case numbers and hospitalizations were high in places like Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston, but nothing like New York, then branded the epicenter of the crisis in the U.S. After a partial reopening in Texas, case numbers began to spike here, and in recent days, the healthcare situation in Texas's biggest city has echoed that of New York City back in March. What Elmhurst Hospital in Queens was back then. Places like Houston Methodist have become in recent days. So writes Pulitzer Prize-winning correspondent Dr. Sherry Fink, who's been covering the pandemic for the New York Times. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
What about what you've seen at hospitals in the Houston area remind you of what you saw in New York, in particular at Elmhurst in Queens?
So I spent time in about 7 different New York City hospitals during our peak. And I think that's true here, too, that different hospitals, even just being a few miles away from each other, can have very different experiences just because the local population could be affected differently. So the similarities are just that we are seeing hospitals admitting patient after patient with COVID. They are having to do something called surge, which is to add beds to create entirely new intensive care units in places where there weren't ICUs before. And then, of course, a bed is one thing, but having to staff those, get enough nurses and specialists who can provide that type of very specialized care for very, very sick patients. And then, of course, many, many moderately sick COVID patients who need some kind of breathing support. It's really, really hard. It's hard on the staff and, of course, the patients themselves. And so it feels very similar in that way to be in a hospital now in Houston as it did in New York City in March, April, even some of May.
The images out of New York during that period were astonishing. It appeared that hospitals were truly overwhelmed. What I'm curious about is, have you seen Texas hospitals, Houston area hospitals, facing that same sort of sense of being completely overwhelmed?
I would say that in my discussions with people who are in the leadership of the Harris Health System, these are the public hospitals that are sort of a safety net for uninsured patients, patients who have Medicaid, those hospitals have lower capacity to take new patients, to create new whole new areas. So according to their leaders, they have reached a sort of a limit in terms of what they can do. And so we've seen for weeks now that those hospitals are transferring patients out to even other parts of the state, as far as Bryan, Texas. And some of the Texas Medical Center hospitals are taking some of Harris Health patients. You know, you can even see some load leveling going on, patients being transferred in between some of the hospital systems here, the larger private hospital systems. So that is similarly occurring. You know, early on, a couple weeks ago, we heard in Texas, these are younger patients, they aren't as sick as they were in New York. That is true, but then also there's that factor of time, and it takes many weeks from getting exposed, then getting infected, then getting sick, mm-hmm. being admitted to a hospital, and then declining and becoming critically ill. So we always expected that some of these more very, very sick patients who require that very specialized, close attention, just incredibly sensitive care where all of their systems are being supported, the ventilators, the drips for their blood pressure, that requires two-on-one nursing, sometimes even one-on-one nursing. And that wave of the sicker patients is hitting now.
There's also a sort of a larger climate and attitude about the coronavirus that seems to have evolved over time. Do you sense that that's having an impact when it comes to the way that people are being treated, say, in Houston versus New York?
Well, that's what I'm being told. And I was really struck when Mark Boone, the physician who's the chief executive at Houston Methodist, said, if there was one thing that I would want from New York's experience in the spring, was that sense of national unity. So at that time, if you remember, there was a national pause, and leaders on the federal and state and local level were pretty much in line with what needed to be done to stop this terrifying spread of the virus and toll of the virus. And of course, that's gone away. And a lot of the medical staff I'm meeting, they feel a real sympathy for the patients who are getting sick, because they said, you know, with so many messages out there, mixed messages about how to keep safe or what is acceptable risk, that people just don't really know, and they're confused. It's really, really tough.
Dr. Sherry Fink is covering the coronavirus pandemic for the New York Times. Dr. Fink, thanks again.
Thank you.
We're just weeks away now from schools reopening in Texas, and there's still quite a few questions about what school during a pandemic will look like. At the moment, the Texas Education Agency is requiring schools to offer in-person instruction, but there will likely be a mix of virtual learning, too. The exact format will probably vary district to district, which is why over the next few weeks we're speaking with superintendents from across the state about what back-to-school in their district will look like. We're beginning with Roland Hernandez. He is superintendent of Corpus Christi ISD. Superintendent Hernandez, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
At the moment, what is the plan for Corpus Christi ISD students when school resumes in August?
Well, our current plan right now is to have our first day of class on August 13th. We'll be offering the face-to-face instruction as well as the remote learning. And we are preparing our schools just to make sure that we are distancing our students as much as possible and making sure that we're adhering to all the orders that are in place, whether it's from our governor or the Texas Education Agency, and then just making sure that we're getting our students registered and understanding what their preference of instructional delivery is. Our biggest question right now is just exactly how many students will return to face-to-face. That certainly is going to help us plan. We will be using all of the PPE as far as the face mask, and yes, students will be expected to wear their face mask while they're in class. And our approach really is to limit the amount of movement for our students in and about the schools. An example would be during the lunch period. We'll limit that as much as possible and be serving lunch to our kids in their classroom.
What would trigger going to a completely outside the classroom or remote format that many schools use during the end of the spring semester?
Right. So that would be triggered just by the assessment of what's going on in the community at that time. If there seems to be a spike where they're having trouble containing and controlling the spread, that our county judge, our mayor, or even the governor at some point picks specific parts of the state that might need to get a little bit more limited on and restricted on what they can do is what might do that for us.
I want to ask about a practical consideration, though. Let's say that you have a situation in which a student comes to school and they're sick, or you've had someone at school, they report in absent, and you've come to find out that they have been diagnosed as having the COVID-19 virus, the coronavirus. Then what do you do? Do you close school in person or what?
Yes, you would. Certainly need to identify the student and get a better understanding of what exactly took place. You know, a difference, of course, of a student being exposed and a student testing positive. Removing that student from the situation and then informing the school of what has taken place. In that particular case, we would close the school down for up to 5 days, if not longer, quarantine the student who is tested positive, as well as the students around that student in those classes.
What are your concerns as far as what the pandemic's effect might be on your district's budget, both immediately and long term?
I think that's a very good point, and it certainly is probably, if not the highest, one of the highest concerns for all district superintendents. We rely heavily on our funding. It is what helps us do what we need to do. Everybody is impacted by funding in the school and what we can provide for our students. So at the same time that we're being told we need to open our schools in August, we're certainly doing it in a way that's compliant with our agency to be able to qualify for the funding that's there. I do think that they are listening to superintendents and providing some transition plans that wouldn't jeopardize school districts and get in their funding. And they continue to listen to what these hardships are for schools, whether it's hold harmless measures in place or not. But that's the way, and that's the kind of conversation that we need to keep having.
Roland Hernandez is the superintendent of Corpus Christi ISD. Superintendent Hernandez, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
You bet. Thank you so much.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring what Texans are talking about on this election day. Hello there, Wells.
Hi, David. Good to be with you. It is primary election day, so I'll be back with the buzz from social media later in the show. For now, with school just weeks away, as we've been hearing, we're hearing from parents and educators about what they think the fall will hold. Via Twitter, Katie Spence says, I'm a parent and planning on keeping my kids at home to do distance learning. I'm worried for the teachers and staff. They need so much more support from our state and federal government to reopen safely. Randoak77 tweets us that in addition to educating children, schools are a daycare. How will distance learning and new schedules impact a parent's ability to work and help recover the economy, they ask. And Dallas tweets us in response that this is the reason conservative leaders suddenly care so much about public education. If schools are closed, parents can claim unemployment. Republicans are willing to crash the medical system so they don't have to take care of families. Some of the responses we're seeing out there, David. I'll be back with more later in the program.
We'd love to hear your thoughts, too. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you, and he'll be back with more of the Talk of Texas in 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Tech University's online school program, TTU K-12, offering fully online courses for kindergarten through 12th grade to start anytime from anywhere. Learn more by searching TTU K-12.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. More than 50,000 Texans working in oil and gas have lost their jobs this year. In Houston, companies like Halliburton have furloughed or laid off thousands of employees, and oil prices aren't expected to rebound anytime soon as a result of the coronavirus. For some workers, it's starting to sound a lot like the 1980s, when oil prices plummeted and stayed low for years. But is it really the same now? Houston Public Media's Kyra Buckley has been looking for answers and hearing from some with firsthand recollections.
In 1987, Deborah Byers was 24 years old, fresh out of college, and she had never lived in a big city until she joined the Houston office for consulting firm Ernst & Young. As it turned out, 1987 was a very bad year for the oil economy.
That was the bottom of the bus there in the 80s.
Byers says she immediately started to help oil and gas companies recover.
Houston had laid off a ton of people, and we were on a skeleton crew, which meant that I did everything. So they didn't have a lot of staff, and suddenly we had all this work because of the restructuring work and the bankruptcy work.
Her spouse is from Houston, and Byers says she experienced the effects of the oil crash through his eyes.
He told me he's never seen traffic on the Katy Freeway or the Southwest Freeway as light as it was.
Some in Houston are concerned we'll return to the empty freeways and office buildings of the 1980s, as oil prices today hover around $40 a barrel, about 15 bucks less than what many companies need to make a profit. Jim Duncan has worked in Houston Oil and Gas since 1978. Among his past job titles is Chief Data Strategist for ConocoPhillips.
You got to describe Houston pre-1980s. As we don't need any other business.
Duncan says the 80s bust forced the industry to rethink the entire supply chain. And today, the oil market looks a lot different. He says companies have more tools, technology, and safeguards in place.
We found some degrees of freedom and maybe even some cost savings that we didn't have before. How each individual company chooses to deploy that in the future, it's going to be interesting to watch.
But we're seeing massive job losses that, to oil and gas bankruptcy attorney Charlie Beckham, feel like deja vu.
Thousands of people who had dreamed of and had worked in the oil industry lost their jobs, from oil field workers to folks with college degrees.
During this downturn, an industry analysis shows Texas has lost 57,000 jobs just in the oil field services sector, the most by far of any state. Beckham's firm, Haynes & Boone, has tracked at least four oil company bankruptcies in Houston since April. He says changes in bankruptcy proceedings since the 80s will help businesses restructure. And overall, sure, Houston's economy is much more diverse today with things like healthcare and technology. But
what I don't know, and I'm not an economist, is it diversified enough?
Since Deborah Byers started in 87, she's seen four major cycles in the industry. She's now the U.S. leader for oil and gas at Ernst & Young. She predicts a new era of moderate prices, just like after the 1980s, when oil prices stayed pretty much flat for a decade. Byers says this will force Houston-based businesses to look for new ways to serve the world's energy needs.
Here we are with really the most innovative companies, the companies that really know how energy systems work. So I still have a lot of confidence.
And she says energy companies will eventually have to transition away from oil, even after they recover from the big bust of 2020. I'm Kyra Buckley in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Activists continue to push for the removal of Confederate monuments across Texas, but it's not just statues that are stamped with that chapter of history. As KERA's Bill Zeeble reports, Texas counties and even a state university bear Confederate names.
On the campus of Texas A&M University, chanting protesters and counter-protesters clashed over the 102-year-old statue of Lawrence Sullivan Ross, also known as Sully. Ross was the 19th governor of Texas and a president of A&M. He was also a general of the Confederate Army. Some Aggie students and alums demanded the statue come down, while others said no way. As of now, the statue still stands. This Sully schism swelled after a white Minneapolis police officer killed George Floyd, an unarmed black man. Black Lives Matter. 500 miles away, in far west rural Texas, hundreds marched for Black Lives Matter. The town of Alpine, population 6,000, is home to Sol Ross State University.
It would take an act of the legislature to change it.
That's Pete Gallego, brand new president of Sol Ross State University. And he should know because he's a former congressman and state legislator.
There's nothing that I or anyone else can do locally that would have any impact on the name of this university.
Gallego says while most everyone on campus knows Ross's history, he's heard no one demand a name change. The school is considering renaming some buildings to recognize the university's first Black and Latino graduates. Southern Methodist University history professor Ariel Ron says there is a precedent for changing school names.
During the American Revolution, they toppled the statue of King George in New York. They renamed King's College Columbia University. And that's an American thing to do. It's a thing that's done around the world.
In the case of Ross, historians say any change is complex because of his Confederate involvement and his career in public service and education. Greg Cantrell, history professor at Texas Christian University, applies this test.
Is the person remembered primarily because of their defense of slavery, their service to the Confederacy, or anything else sort of relating to racism?
Paul Quinn College Associate Professor Irvin James saw the Ross statue all the time while attending A&M. He knew Ross had run the school. Now he knows the Confederate story.
He was much more to Texas A&M than a Confederate soldier, right? President, governor, very integral part of building up the university there. So there is ample reason to take either side.
James would keep the statue, but might consider moving it. TCU professor Cantrell would keep the statue too.
But also inform readers that, you know, by our modern standards, there were some things in his military career that we don't necessarily endorse.
Cantrell would endorse the same approach to names. Saul Ross State University sits in Brewster County, which borders Terrell and Jeff Davis counties. Henry Brewster and Alexander Terrell were Confederate Army generals. Davis led the Confederate states. At least 24 other Texas counties, including Hood, were named for Confederate leaders.
John Bell Hood is really remembered for, you know, being the commanding officer of Hood's Texas Brigade in the Confederate Army. And I think it would be entirely appropriate to rename that county.
But changing a county's name would be up to state lawmakers. And Cantrell says he's not holding his breath. I'm Bill Zeeble.
We're fast approaching 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. The Texas Roundup is next. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. Polls across Texas are open until 7 tonight for the primary runoff election. KERA's Brett Jaspers has more.
Democrats across the state are choosing between MJ Hagar and Royce West, and the winner will face U.S. Senator John Cornyn, the Republican incumbent. There are several congressional runoffs around the state in both parties as well. And let's not forget other local choices on the ballot. Hyder Garcia is Tarrant County Elections Administrator.
If you are a voter who lives in Fort Worth and you don't participate in primaries because you don't consider yourself a Republican or a Democrat, you can still vote on the city election.
Garcia is referring to a ballot proposition in Fort Worth to extend a sales tax that sends additional funding to the police. Social distancing measures are in widespread use at the polls. Officials strongly encourage voters to wear masks, but it's not mandatory. I'm Brett Jaspers in Dallas.
The U.S. military is deploying additional medical staff to help Texas hospitals treat COVID-19 patients, which have totaled more than 10,000 statewide since Friday. The governor's office says 9 more Army and Navy medical units will be heading to areas in the most need. The first team set up in San Antonio last week. Another arrived in Houston on Monday. The University of Texas announced some changes Monday to address racial inequality on campus and its athletics programs. As KUT's Jimmy Moss reports, UT is once again trying to figure out how to reconcile its racist past while preparing for a more diverse future.
First, the eye-catching stuff. What was called the Joe Jamail Field at DKR Texas Memorial Stadium will now be named the Earl Campbell and Ricky Williams Field. The school will also honor its first Black football letterman, Julius Whittier, with a statue nearby. The Longhorns will still be listening to the Eyes of Texas before and after every game, but the school says it will teach its origins and work to reimagine its future. Some big changes on campus as well. there will be more robust efforts to recruit black students, faculty, and staff, an effort Clotilde Davis-Haynes has been asking for decades. She is president of the Precursors, an alumni group of African Americans who enrolled in the early years of UT Austin's desegregation.
I see, for the first time in a long time, significant movement toward addressing these very complicated and complex issues.
The Precursors, along with Heman Sweat, will have their stories memorialized on campus as well. One building, Robert L. Moore Hall, is getting renamed. It will now just be called the Physics, Math, and Astronomy Building.
Jimmy Moss in Austin. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Bitty bitty bom bom. Not the sort of expression you hear much in the halls of higher education, but that's about to change, at least at one university in Texas. In what is being called a first, the Queen of Tejano Music, Selena Quintanilla, will be the focus of one of the newest courses in the Department of Race, Ethnicity, Gender, and Sexuality Studies in the College of Education and Development at the University of Texas at San Antonio. The full title of the course, Selena, A Mexican-American Identity and Experience. The creator of the course joins us now, Sonia Alemán. She is Associate Professor of Mexican-American Studies at UTSA. Professor Alemán, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I hear this has been something of a dream for you for a long time. Were you a fan?
I was. I was growing up here in San Antonio when she was in her heyday, so I got to see her perform live many times and have played her music throughout the years. She was not only the soundtrack of my young adulthood, but helped raise my children and teach them what Tejano music is all about.
Tell us a little bit about what inspired you to create a course, a college course, about Selena.
Well, it just pulls together the intersection of all my research interests and teaching interests regarding racial identity, identity formation, representation, and I really wanted something that was rooted in the population that I'm working with now. Part of that dream is teaching students that are like me, that are from places like me, that look like me, and so that's who I get to work with and teach at UTSA as a Hispanic-serving institution, and so for me, it made perfect sense to draw from someone that's already so much a part of their who they are and the culture here to be able to talk about those issues.
Let's talk a little bit about the sort of the topics, I suppose you could say, because there is a lot of theory that's built around the identity of Selena, right? And what Selena, not just who she was, but what she means to a community.
Yeah, I think that there have been most of the conversations about what she means and really trying to figure out, you know, why she continues to cultivate new fans, fans who, you know, were not alive when she was, but they still feel this connection, trying to make sense of what that means, why that's so strong. And I don't think that there is a simple answer. I think that there's a whole multitude of reasons why that's the case. As a media studies scholar who understands the power of representation, I think one of the major factors or one of the factors is the fact that we have so few icons or images of someone who looks exactly like a Chicana from this part of the world, a Mexican-American woman from this part of the world that has her status in terms of recognition, in terms of her presence, her continued presence. And so I think it matters when we have, when we've been kind of starved or we have that absence of other images, we're going to cling to the one that resonates and still has a hold for us.
What are you going to be asking students to do to reconsider Selena in light of the American or Texan or Mexican experience? How do you imagine students interacting with Selena and the ideas that you're mentioning there?
I hope that it does two things. One, that they realize how valuable it is to have courses that are centered on their experiences of being a Mexican American. Those conversations have not been central in their K-12 education so far, even in the state of Texas. And so knowing that there's knowledge and wisdom and something of import to learn there, to be able to have a respect for that discipline and for what it offers as a way to continue exploring that. And two, I hope that it then allows them to kind of, if you will, transfer the love and the passion and the adoration that they have for her to their own larger community and their own selves, and understanding why there's some, you know, contradictions and mixtures, you know, built into what it's like to be a Mexican American in South Texas.
Ultimately, what will be the mark of success for this class? What are you hoping that students will get out of it?
I mean, I really hope that we can make it as good of an experience online this first time around, since that wasn't how I intended for it to unfold. Mm-hmm. I really do hope that this becomes a signature class for our department that really marks like the kinds of conversations that we think are important, that should be central to someone who is educated through our university and understands why we're a Hispanic serving institution, why this is important to the curriculum, and that they then, you know, go on and tell people why they should take it and then take another Mexican American Studies class from us.
Sonia Alemán is professor of Mexican American Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio, and she will be teaching Selena, a Mexican American Identity and Experience, this fall. Professor, congratulations on the new course, and thanks for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You know, we've been hearing a lot about calls for changes in policing at schools. Who's pushing for change the hardest? You may be surprised, or perhaps not. That's coming up next on The Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In the wake of protests after the killing of George Floyd, school districts in other parts of the country voted to remove police from their schools. So far, no Texas districts have followed suit, but there's a growing debate on the matter. In San Antonio, some of the strongest support for an end to school policing comes from students, as Texas Public Radio's Camille Phillips reports.
When Marsha Madrigal was in middle school, she thought it was normal to see her classmates in handcuffs. One incident in particular from her eighth grade year at Longfellow Middle School is burned into her memory. She was given 2 weeks of in-school suspension after her Spanish teacher noticed that the tips of her hair were dyed dark purple.
But you had either a fair-skinned, like, Latina woman or, you know, a white girl who attended the same middle school as me and had her whole hair dyed bright pink. And she was never subjected to the same harsh disciplinary measures as I was.
Madrigal says she was one of four black girls at Longfellow, and three out of the four were in in-school suspension with her.
And when there's only four of us, but, you know, the 75% of us are, you know, in suspension where we're not allowed to collect the work that we need to, you know, stay on track.
She says those 2 weeks showed her how easy it would have been to get caught up in a cycle of punishments until she landed in the criminal justice system or dropped out of school.
So it's easy to just be like, you know, I'm not doing anything anyway, so might as well just not come, and then you get more OCI. And then by the time you get out of OCI or out of suspension, you're 4 weeks behind, a month behind, on top of, you know, everything else that you have to deal with in terms of your home environment.
Add that to feeling like no one wants you at school anyways, and it's a recipe for disaster. Madrigal says she never felt like she could fully be herself at school.
I can't act out because automatically I become like the angry, mad black woman. I have to hold myself to a higher standard than anybody else.
Madrigal is now 20 and a student at Howard University in Washington, D.C. She knows that her experience at San Antonio ISD is similar to the experience of students of color across the country, who are both more likely to attend a school with a police presence and more likely to be disciplined and arrested. She and dozens of other current and former SAISD students joined other advocates in flooding the district's budget meeting with calls to eliminate funding for the district's police department late last month.
In a district that is predominantly black and brown, the board needs to acknowledge that routine policing is harmful and cops should not be involved in any form of discipline as it perpetuates the criminalization of students of color.
After listening to nearly 2 hours of public comments read aloud by the district's chief of staff, SAISD trustees approved the budget without making any cuts to funding for the police department. Board President Patty Radel says other community members want police to stay and that the district police department is already short on funds.
It's not a matter of taking money out of the police department. It's a matter of continuing to seek for more funds because we need a whole lot more strength in the counseling and in the social work and in mental health.
While the board is not considering getting rid of the district's police department, Radel says the board is already doing a lot of the other things commenters wanted.
We know we have a lot of work to do. We just want people to notice that we've been working on it. You know, we're not starting from zero here.
Trustees approved a new policy last fall that says police aren't supposed to be involved in school discipline and encourages school leaders to avoid suspensions. But student activists currently enrolled at SAISD schools say the new policy hasn't really changed anything. Alejo Peña Soto is a rising senior at Jefferson High School.
I've seen instances where police have enforced sort of punishment for just really minuscule things like having your hood on in the hallway or, you know, sagging your pants, things that they shouldn't be getting involved with, but they still do.
His classmate, Nicole Garcia, says officers still routinely interrupt class to search for drugs.
It's usually just random. You never know. They will just like knock on the door and then all the students have to leave. And then they usually will have a dog there with them to kind of sniff around to see if there's any drugs. And usually, you know, they never find any sort of drugs.
Several students told TPR that officers are also still called at the first sign that a conflict might get physical. Hallie Gilliland was a freshman at Sam Houston High School's PTEC program last year. She says a teacher called the cops when a suspended student brushed past her to try to get out the door.
And then they flipped him and put him on the ground and, like, aggressively put him on the ground. And it was very, very, very uncalled for.
Gilliland doesn't think all police need to leave schools, but she says the ones who remain need to have the right training and personality to work with students. San Antonio students and other advocates who do want an end to school policing know that they don't have widespread support in Texas yet. Just a few years ago, many people were calling for an increase in school police after school shootings in Parkland and Santa Fe. However, researchers haven't found clear evidence that an officer on campus prevents school shootings. That's why Paula Johnson, with the Intercultural Development Research Association, says school-based police officers give people a false sense of security.
But the fact that they're there presents a danger to our children of color, especially Black boys, because, just by their presence, because then people are calling on them to engage these students rather than having other types of conversations.
Researchers have found clear evidence that students of color are arrested more frequently and have lower graduation rates when there's an increased police presence. As a parent and former teacher, Johnson says she understands the desire to keep kids safe. But she believes that as long as police are present in schools, they put students of color at greater risk of falling into the school-to-prison pipeline.
They're not policing the buildings. Like to protect the building and students inside from safety, their mindset is protecting students and teachers from students.
Police are such an accepted part of American society that it may feel strange to consider removing them from schools, says Burbank High School teacher Luke Amphlett. He's a member of the Teacher Union's Social Justice Caucus.
I'm a huge believer in democracy, but I also think that we have to make sure that we push back on the idea that things that are wrong are acceptable if lots of people think them.
While students and other advocates would like to see police completely removed from their schools, they say a good first step would be for the district to fully implement the changes necessary to live up to the promise of the handbook it adopted last year. Jefferson High School senior Alejo Peña Soto says that includes ensuring that officers truly stop enforcing school discipline and truly listen to what students have to say.
I think the district is quick to dismiss what we propose because we're students sometimes. They feel like we don't understand what's going on, but we do.
He and other student advocates hope that the flood of public comments during the board meeting last month has opened the door to a real conversation about the role of police in schools. I'm Camille Phillips in San Antonio.
Rice University is getting creative with its plans for in-person classes for the fall semester. New York Times reports that Rice is setting up 9 large outdoor classrooms on campus. 4 will be semi-permanent structures to be built in an open field near campus dorms. 5 of the 9 are so-called circus tents, according to Kevin Kirby, Rice's vice president for administration. He told the Times that the spaces will be decorated with murals and video projections by students and faculty.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, welcoming visitors back to the historic beach town. Tours with social distancing at Moody Mansion, Bryan Museum, and Bishop's Palace. More at galveston.com. It's Island Time, with safety in mind.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The drought of the 1950s is widely regarded as Texas's worst. For 6 years, temperatures rose and rain nearly ceased. A catastrophe that put many farmers out of business, shifted Texas's population center from rural to urban, and sapped billions from the Texas economy. But that drought may look tame compared with what Texas may face in the not-too-distant future. A new study in the journal Earth's Future projects that the second half of the 21st century could be Texas's driest of the last 1,000 years. Joining us now to talk about that is one of the authors of the study, state climatologist John Nielsen Gammon. Professor Nielsen Gammon, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Yeah, thank you.
Tell us a bit about how you and the other researchers involved in this study came to these conclusions.
Well, we looked at the historical record of droughts, mainly from tree rings and also more recently measurements. But with tree rings, we were able to go back 1,000 years. And then we compared that to computer model projections of things like soil moisture and stream flow that indicate dry conditions. And what we found is not that the entire second half of the 21st century would be as dry as the 50s, but that it would be as dry as the prolonged droughts of the past, or perhaps even worse. And that means the conditions on average will be drier than we're used to. And when we do get those extreme droughts will be drier as well.
Well, you know, you think about West Texas and how rugged and rough it is when it comes to just habitability. What does this mean for the habitability of West Texas and other parts of Texas in the future?
I think a good way of thinking about what we're facing is to imagine that every place in Texas is moving west. So, for example, San Angelo becomes more like Midland, Austin becomes more like San Angelo, Houston becomes more like Austin. So the whole ecosystem shifts, and our expectations about how much water will be available will shift also. People live in the desert, so it's not like the end of the world, but it means we're going to have to dig deeper, both literally and metaphorically, to find the water that we need.
Well, in that case, what should we be doing now for a drier future? What would you be recommending to state leaders? Because I know that they've been talking, at least since the 50s, about a variety of different plans.
And there are a variety of options. Some are more expensive than others, so water will probably cost more in the future. But the main thing is first to be thinking about the future in these terms, that if we just plan for a repeat of the drought of record, we're going to become more and more vulnerable over time to seeing a drought that exceeds what we're planning for. So allowing for a little margin of error or trying to obtain some hard numbers for projections would be helpful in the long run.
But I think a lot of people listening to us would say, well, wait a minute, we're talking about a lack of rain. We're talking about increased temperatures. What can you do as a practical matter today to offset what could happen tomorrow?
Well, it is true that the humanity, is causing the increased temperatures through global warming. And it's not just increased drought. It's a whole set of problems that are going to be exacerbated by climate change. So we can also reduce emissions of carbon dioxide, for example, to reduce the magnitude of global warming. The problem is that's something that has to happen basically on a global scale, whereas for adapting to drier conditions, which is going to happen to some extent no matter what, it's really only up to us.
And what do those adaptations mean? Are we talking about bringing in water from other parts of the country? What literally could Texas do?
Well, water is pretty difficult to move across state because people tend to want to hang on to their water, and it's very difficult to move it across Texas, in fact. But there's always reducing the amount of water use, for example, reducing the amount of water that's used on lawns and so forth. We have the ability to tap into resources of what's called brackish groundwater that has too much salt to drink, but that salt can be removed. And in a real worst-case scenario, tapping into seawater. But one problem with Texas is it's hard to get water uphill, and most of our water is available at the lowest elevations. So we're fighting a battle that's pretty challenging.
John Nielsen-Gammon is Texas's state climatologist and director of the Texas Center for Climate Studies at Texas A&M University. Professor Nielsen-Gammon, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Yeah, you're welcome. My pleasure.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. And Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas once again on this Tuesday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. We're continuing to hear about plans to reopen schools safely in time for the fall semester. Via Facebook, Dan Grunewald reaches out with his thoughts on the Corpus Christi superintendent interview we heard earlier in the show. He writes, "I teach in a high school computer lab setting. It's going to be impossible to keep a room with so many touch points clean. It's going to be unsafe to expect 30 kids plus me to be in that classroom at once, and it's just asking for disaster to add in-room lunch to a classroom like mine." He says that elected and appointed officials are putting business as usual ahead of public health and safety. And echoing several other comments we've received, this via Twitter, Glenn Ray says, "I have yet to hear any comprehensive plan for reopening schools that addresses the health of teachers and support staff. Already underpaid and overworked, they're now being ignored from the equation." And I should add, David, it was very illustrative hearing that interview with the Corpus superintendent, because it really does display how the difference between ISDs and how they pretty much got a plan in place. Other big districts like ours here in Austin still waiting to hear their specifics, with the schools just weeks away.
I don't know if you've seen this, because this is a new story coming out of your hometown, Wells. El Paso City County, County Health Authority on July 9th ordered that classrooms can't reopen until September 8th. Now, move is at odds with the TEA agency mandate that schools reopen with the new school year. So a lot of teachers across the Lone Star State with their eyes on what's happening in El Paso, because that could have major statewide implications if the governor lets it stand.
Yeah, big disconnect between that TEA edict that calls for, 5 days of in-person instruction if the parents so request it. So obviously, still hanging fire on that one. Well, as else we've been talking about, it is primary election day here in Texas, hearing from tons of folks about whether or not they voted early, whether or not they're brave in the polls today, how that's shaken out. And here's what we're hearing via Facebook. Cynthia Ingram Swaim says she voted early even without COVID-19. It's pretty silly not to vote early, in my opinion. And Cindy Ray, she says she never received her mail-in ballot, so in person it is. And we have heard some cases out there of people receiving perhaps ballots for the wrong races. I believe Ashley Lopez, reporter at her home station KUT Austin, has a story today about some ballots being returned to the people that mailed them in. Of course, big races out there. Lynn Watson Guy says she voted and is watching that Democratic runoff in the U.S. Senate to determine and who will oppose John Cornyn. Lindsay Mansis, she says she voted early, and she's watching her district, Texas 24. She knows that Kenny Merchant is retiring and has held his position since she was in middle school. She's 31 now. And also, I love this, Linda Crisp. She's working the polls today. She sent us a selfie with the mask and the face shield. So taking the precautions there.
You know, we have reporters all across the state, from Texas Public Radio, KERA, Houston Public Media, KUT in Austin, Marfa Public Radio. They're all keeping up with what's happening across the day, and you can keep up at the hashtag TXDecides. Hope you can join us again tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Holdridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.